Thing. Does it still feel like Christmas? No? Well, today is in fact the 12th day of Christmas. The first day of Christmas is Christmas Day, and today is the 12th day of Christmas. And tomorrow is the day that we celebrate Epiphany. Last week, Nathan talked about the Magi referenced in Matthew chapter 2, 1 to 12, with tomorrow being Epiphany, the day that traditionally the Christian church celebrates the manifestation of Christ to the Gentiles through the Magi. I'd like to focus on the same story, but I'd like to focus on the character of Herod. We've been focusing on different characters through the Christmas story and Advent season here, so a bit of a disclaimer before I begin. My focus today is more historical than theological. I want to give us a bit of the historical and political backdrop to the Christmas story. Specifically, I want to unpack what we may miss when we read through Matthew and he drops names like Herod or Egypt and in Matthew chapter 2. What did Matthew assume that his readers knew that we just miss? Why did Matthew talk about Herod when Mark didn't and John didn't and Luke references him just once? Why is Herod important at all to the Christmas story? Imagine that you're reading through the Bible for the first time, right? And you're reading through from beginning Genesis all the way through the end. And you've kind of read through the Old Testament. You've read about Abraham and God's chosen people. And then you get to the kings, right? King David, King Solomon. And then, you know, it's kind of the prime years, the best years of God's chosen people. And then you have this exile into Babylon. And you have Persia kind of conquering Babylon and then giving the Jews some freedom again and going back. They get to go back to the Israel, rebuild their temple, and then you have all these prophets. And you get to the book of Micah, right? Right at the end, or sorry, Malachi, right at the end of the Old Testament. And Malachi is like it is such an Old Testament book. It's got this blessing and cursing language that you'd become very familiar with. There's reference to that temple that the Persians allowed the Jews to come back and rebuild in Jerusalem. It's such an Old Testament book. You become very familiar with it. Then you turn the page and you get to Matthew. And in Matthew chapter 1, the first thing you read is a genealogy about Jesus, the Messiah, and Matthew links him to all of these famous people and all this lineage of God's chosen people that you've been reading about. This is the one the Jewish people have been waiting for. And then in the second half of the chapter, he starts talking about Joseph and Mary and Jesus. He kind of gives you this birth narrative. And then you get to Matthew chapter 2. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem village, Judah territory. Okay, we're in Judah, right? So we've been in Malachi, right? Now we're in Judah. We know where Judah is. We've read about Judah in the Old Testament. We know where we are. This was during Herod's kingship. Wait, what? Kings? There's kings again? What happened? I thought Persia was kind of the big dog. Why do we have a king? Who's this Herod guy? Let's keep reading. A band of scholars arrived in Jerusalem. Okay, Jerusalem, we're familiar with that. From the east. Okay, well, Persia's from the east. Maybe there's something still going on here we don't know about. They asked around, where can we find and pay homage to the newborn king of the Jews? Okay, wait. Now we're talking about kings again of the Jews. What's going on? So, just on the last page of Malachi, we're you know, we're a Jewish, you know, we're reading about God's chosen people being oppressed by the Persians, right? And all these prophecies. And then the very next page, we're reading about kings of the Jews. So what happened? Well, as Protestants, we kind of refer to this one page difference as the 400 years of silence. And basically what we mean by that is that God is not revealing anything new in that 400 years. But what we don't mean by that is that the world was silent and nothing changed, because a ton changed. And we don't actually spend a lot of energy or time thinking about what all changed. So I want to just give us a brief overview. Well, what happens is we have Alexander the Great. I'm sure if you've taken history, you've heard of Alexander the Great. From Greece, he hates the Persians. He's Greek. So he makes it his life mission to conquer the Persian Empire, to wipe them out. If you've heard of or watched the movie 300, that kind of depicts that battle. The other thing he does is, as he conquers the world, he Greekifies everything. So Old Testament is written in Hebrew. The New Testament, except maybe Matthew, the first transcript of Matthew might have been in Hebrew, but all of the rest of the New Testament is definitely in Greek. So he even Greekifies Jerusalem, right? God's chosen people adopt the language of Alexander the Great. Well, that's weird. Then Alexander, he dies young. He doesn't leave an heir, so his generals kind of divide up the territory, and the area of Palestine, Judea, Galilee, whatever you want to call it, ends up under General Seleucus. And the Jewish people do not like this. They kind of liked their quasi-independence under the Persians. They had a lot of freedom under the Persians. They kind of liked that. So there's this rebellion by this family known as the Maccabees. And this leads to a Jewish independent state again between 140 BC and 37 BC, right up until the time of Jesus. And it's independent, right? The Jews have an independent state again, but it's nothing like the days of David and Solomon. It's quite corrupt. There's lots of infighting, and that infighting actually leads to this new power, Rome, coming in and taking over the territory. That all happens with the flip of that one page. So I still haven't answered, where do kings come from? Why, you know, if Rome took over, they're an empire, why wouldn't there just be an emperor? Well, the Romans had a system called the client-king system. So when the Romans conquered a place, they figured out it was to their advantage to put in a local ruler to collect taxes, do all the administration stuff, ensure peace. The Romans might have a governor in place as well to communicate directly with Rome, like Pontius Pilate, right? But usually the local people responded better to a local ruler. So if we talk specifically about Herod, how did he become king? Well, during the Maccabee dynasty, during that period of time where the Jews had their own independent state, the leader, called John Hyrcanus, he kind of goes out to expand the territory, and he captures Edom, this kingdom southeast of Judea. And Herod's father is one of these guys that lives in Edom. He's from Edom. And what he does with this kingdom is he says, you can either become Jewish. So what that means for adult males is you can either get circumcised, tough choice, and obey the Torah, or you can leave or we'll kill you. That's your choice. So Herod's father, he chooses option A, painfully, and he becomes quite influential. Now, when the Romans come in, his influence grows. And then he has a son, and his son is named Herod, and because his influence is growing, and because Herod has made friends with powerful people in Rome, Herod finds himself the governor of Galilee in 47 BC. Now, nobody likes this. See, while on paper, the client-king system looks like it would work well because a local person is ruling, often the Romans didn't really get the whole culture and religious thing with the Jewish people or any places that they really conquered. So in the case of Herod's father and Herod himself, this really shows. If you remember from the Old Testament, the nation of Israel comes from the lineage of Jacob, while the nation of Edom comes from the lineage of Esau. And these people don't like each other. There's lots of war, right, throughout the Old Testament. And now you have this father and his son, Herod, who are converted Edomites, but they're not ethnically Jewish. So the ethnic Jews kind of look at them as they're not quite as good as us, right? So Herod's father dies, and what Herod does is he shrewdly goes straight to Rome to meet with his powerful Roman friends because he wants authority. He wants to be the new client king. And they give it to him. They say, if you can win Judah, then it's yours. You can be the king of Judah. So this is in 37 BC. So what he does, another strike against him, is he brings in a Roman army. And for three bloody years, he takes over Judah. So he's killing Jewish people, right, to become their king. Didn't go over well. The other thing Herod did is that he actually married into the Hasmonean, into the Maccabee family to kind of give up or to kind of bolster his reputation and authority to the throne. But once he becomes king, he starts to feel threatened by this family he's married into. So he ends up killing his wife's mother, killing his wife's brother, and killing his wife's kids, including the two sons that he had with her. So basically, Herod is ambitious, smart, capable, but very morally flexible, and increasingly crazy, and he becomes even more paranoid in his old age. And being a converted Edomite Jew, along with his role of representing Rome, and then killing off any connections to the past rulers, he basically knew that he's an imposter, right? He knew his power, at least from the perspective of the people he was ruling over. He knew that his power was based on basically nothing in their eyes. And what do imposters do? Well, they do crazy things, like they're overly lavish and generous, and they're angry and murderous. So Matthew is writing to an audience who doesn't like this guy at all. There's lots of bad feelings here. Now, to be fair, to give us a little bit of balance, Herod did some good things for the nation of Israel while he ruled. Remember the second temple that Cyrus the Great released the Jews to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild? Well, Herod put a lot of time and energy into expanding the temple, taking it from kind of a modest building to something quite grand. And if you go to the Middle East today, anything that you see left is Herod. That's what he did. He also built a bunch of fortresses, including this one, which is Masada. While they're nice and they're big and they're grand and they function well, they also speak to Herod's paranoia. He was scared that he'd be invaded. He built the port of Caesarea, which you read about later on in the New Testament. It becomes really important in the early church. He named it in honor of Caesar Augustus, right, to kind of appease, keep Rome appeased. He also built numerous other cities in Judea, and actually even for her allies, along with many theaters, stadiums, and aqueducts. This allowed for increased trade. It could be argued that Judea's economy under Herod's rule actually did very well. So now that we know a little bit about who Herod was and how he gained authority and what he did, let's get back to the text. So Matthew chapter 2, verses 3 and 4. When word of their inquiry, it's the wise men here, got to Herod, he was terrified. Well, that kind of fits with him, right? And not Herod alone, but most of Jerusalem as well. So not just King Herod feels scared, but Jerusalem feels scared. But this is for good reason. In this time and place, whenever there's instability in power, right, someone's coming in and saying there's a new king of the Jews, it's normal for people to feel threatened, because what often happened was civil war. But specifically and especially in the case of Herod, anytime he felt threatened, he was especially cruel. I mean, you don't kill your wife and grandmother unless you're incredibly paranoid. Crazy. Caesar said of Herod that it was safer to be his pig than his son. Like, and Caesar didn't have a really good moral compass either. Matthew chapter 2, verses 5 and 6. They told him, Bethlehem, Judea's territory, the prophet Micah wrote it plainly. It's you, Bethlehem, in Judah's land, no longer bringing up the rear. From you will come the leader who will shepherd rule my people, my Israel. So a quick aside here about Matthew. This is very normal Matthew language. He references Micah chapter 5, verse 2 here. And this is a pattern you see throughout his gospel, that he'll go back to the Old Testament and reference something and use it to explain the story of Jesus. And he's doing this for very good reason. Matthew himself is Jewish, and he's writing to convince a Jewish audience. He's writing for the purpose of showing that God has kept his ancient promises to Israel through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, the Messiah. So that's why in chapter 1, Matthew begins by highlighting that Jesus was the son of David, Israel's most famous king, and the son of Abraham, you know, Israel's founding patriarch. He is writing to show that Jesus is the true Israelite and God promised Messiah. And even how he sets up his letter, the Gospel of Matthew, even how he sets it up. In the Torah, there are five books. In Matthew, there are five sections. So Matthew's doing this, and you'll see it throughout even this chapter, but throughout the book, again and again and again, he's saying, the story of Jesus is your story. It's your story. It's your history. So he does it again and again. Matthew chapter 2, 7 to 12, we have here, this is what Nathan spoke about last week. We have Herod secretly meeting with the wise men, asking them when they first saw the star, sending them to Bethlehem, asking them to stop in on their return trip, let them know where this new king was because he wanted to worship him. The wise men go to Bethlehem, they find the house, they worship Jesus, and then they're warned in a dream, so they return another way. And then we pick it up in verse 13. After the scholars were gone, God's angel showed up again in Joseph's dream and commanded, get up, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt. Stay until further notice. Herod is on the hunt for this child and wants to kill him. So to the Jewish audience that Matthew is writing, this is just par for the course. This isn't nothing new. Like, this is so fits with Herod's character. They wouldn't have been surprised. This is just, okay, yep. When we read it and we don't have this other context of how crazy this guy was and paranoid, we're kind of like, oh, this is a big deal. But Matthew's audience is like, oh yeah, this is normal. Normal stuff. I want to talk a little bit about Egypt here because Matthew references Egypt for a really good reason. Egypt would have been a triggering word for Matthew's audience, just like Herod was a triggering word. It came with a huge backstory that we might not actually take the time or remember because it's not our story. So what happened in Egypt? Well, Joseph is famously sold into slavery. He changes and grows in maturity. He helps the pharaohs, but his descendants are enslaved. And then Moses is raised to lead them out of Egypt. And if we go on in verses 14 to 15, we read Joseph. This is a different Joseph, right? Mary and Joseph. Joseph obeyed. He got up, took the child and his mother under the cover of darkness. They were out of town and well on their way to by daylight. They lived in Egypt until Herod's death. This Egyptian exile fulfilled what Hosea had preached. I called my son out of Egypt. So this is Matthew being Matthew again. He's pointing back to Hosea 11, verse 1, and he quotes the second half of that verse. The first half of that verse says, when Israel was a child, I loved him. And then, the second half, I called my son out of Egypt. So the Israelites really became a people group in Egypt, right? When Moses led them out of Egypt to the promised land that God had promised to them, they are birthed as a nation. So what Matthew is doing here is saying, is taking the birth narrative of that Old Testament and he's comparing it with the birth narrative of the completion of the Old Testament in Jesus. He's saying again, the story of Jesus is your story. Think about, we can go on, think about the narrative with baby Moses being put in a basket because Pharaoh, the god king of the Egyptians, wants to kill all the babies. And Moses gets rescued. As he grows up, God uses him to redeem the situation, even though he was very flawed. And Moses leads them out of Egypt into the promised land. So he's referencing that story by saying Egypt. Matthew is referencing that story. And he's also saying then, at the same time, Jesus is the new Moses. He's lobbed forward into the future. So Herod is now this king, out to defend his own sovereignty and authority. And how does he do it? He tries to kill all the babies, like Pharaoh did. And as a new Moses, if we read on in Matthew, Jesus is rescued because God is still in control. So, why does Matthew do this? Why is he doing this? Well, Matthew's Jewish audience has a mind that operates quite differently than ours does. We're not talking about an audience here that needs to be reached by propositional argumentation, you know, facts, evidence. You know, when we want to convince, much like we do, right? When we want to convince someone that Jesus was real, we want to point to the facts. We want to point to the evidence that he was born in this time and place and he really died and he really rose on this day. If we can do that, then we're convinced. But Matthew's audience had placed a really high value in story and story arcs. So stories were a vehicle in which truth was carried for Matthew's Jewish audience. So when Matthew compares the story of the Israelites with the story of Jesus and goes back and forth and back and forth again and again and again, that would have been powerful. Couple more here. Matthew 2, 16 to 18. Herod, when he realized that the scholars had tricked him, flew into a rage. He commanded the murder of every little boy 2 years old and under who lived in Bethlehem and its surrounding hills. He determined that age from the information he'd gotten from the scholars. That's when Jeremiah's sermon was fulfilled. A sound was heard in Ramah, weeping and much lament. Rachel's weeping for her children. Rachel refusing all solace. Her children gone, dead and buried. One of the pushbacks you may hear about the credibility of this passage is that no other historian anywhere writes about this awfully cruel event. But there are theories about that. One of them is this is right at the end of Herod's life, and the way Herod dies is a crazy story in itself, and it might have just overshadowed this event. The other thing is Bethlehem, when we think about it, like when we think about this, when I thought about this when I was writing this, I'm like, oh, well, like 200 babies, maybe 500, maybe like how many babies are we talking? Well, Bethlehem's a really small town, was mostly made up of peasants and unimportant people. We're probably talking, it's still awful, but we're probably talking about 10 babies. About just a very small, well, a smaller number. Matthew itself was written between about 70 AD, maybe as late as 110. There are some reports that it might have been written a bit earlier. But this would have been within living memory of the people, or some people, and it still survives, so there is some credibility in that. But why does Matthew reference Jeremiah 31, verse 15 here? If you remember, Jeremiah is the guy in the Old Testament who talks about Nebuchadnezzar and the exile to Babylon, and basically the story is that Nebuchadnezzar does great harm to the people, the chosen people of God, and there is mourning and difficulty and generations of Jewish people that are living away from home, but there's also redemption and hope. And that's very similar to the story that Matthew's telling right now. Herod's doing great harm to God's chosen people. He's killing babies. But there's a larger redemptive theme here that despite all this evil from authorities and governments is going on, Jesus is going to make things right. He's going to bring healing. So Matthew's saying, keep paying attention. There's more of this. We end off Matthew chapter 2, 19 to 23 with Herod's death. So later when Herod died, God's angel appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt. Up, take the child and the mother and return to Israel. All those out to murder the child are dead. So Joseph obeys. He got up, took the child and his mother and re-entered Israel. When he heard, though, that Archelaus, also known as Herod Archelaus, had succeeded his father Herod the Great as king in Judea, he was afraid to go there. But then Joseph was directed in a dream to go to the hills of Galilee. On arrival, he settled in the village of Nazareth. This move was a fulfillment of the prophetic words, he shall be called a Nazarene. Herod's death was a very messy affair. The historical record tells us that he ends up getting a disease that made him stink a lot. Some people think it was gangrene, maybe some form of that. And because of his paranoia and past killing sprees, his Jewish subjects didn't really like him, and Herod was scared that when on the day he would die, there'd be a celebration. So he talks to his sister. Now, his sister is like the only family member he has left that has any relationship with him because he's been so erratic and murderous. So what he says to his sister is they should capture all the important people in Israel, bring them into the Hippodrome, which is this horse racing stadium that he built, and then not tell them why they're there, and then on the day that he dies, murder them all so that he would have the legacy of dying. When he died, there'd be great mourning in the land. This is just another story of many, and another story that Matthew's audience would have known when they read this, that show how crazy he was. Now, thankfully, his sister didn't carry out his orders. But you can imagine that succession planning was, when you treat your family this way and your subjects this way, is really difficult. So before we close, I want to briefly talk about the other Herods referenced in the New Testament. In fact, the Herod family is talked about 50 times in the New Testament. And it's a little bit confusing because sometimes they use a name and sometimes they don't. So who are they talking about? So this is the Herod family with Herod the Great on top. And after he dies, the territory he's ruling over gets split into three and split among his family. Herod Archelaus, which was referenced in Matthew chapter 2, and Joseph didn't want to go there for good reason, kind of ruled over the heartland of Judea and Jerusalem. Now, one story about him in his first moments of leadership, day one of leadership, he's meeting with a bunch of important people, telling them how things are going to be really different under him. And right next door at the temple, there's kind of this disruption going on. So he sends some leaders there, and it didn't help. So he sends another group of leaders there, and they're mistreated. And then he sends another group of leaders there, and they're stoned. So then he's like, I don't want to start this way. So he kind of clears out the bystanders, sends in the army, and murders 3,000 people. Day one. So this is why Mary and Joseph didn't want to go back. Right? This is why. They would have heard this story. Most likely they were living in Egypt among a Jewish population. They would have heard this story. Also interesting, doesn't that sound like a parable that Jesus tells? Right? There's a vineyard, there's a landowner, he sends various levels of authority, they get mistreated and stoned. Yeah, Jesus is riffing off of probably this story of Herod Archelaus. Then we have Herod Antipas. Now, this is the guy that comes up the most in the Bible. He's the guy that, you know, married his brother, Herod Philip's wife or something, and then John the Baptist calls him on it, and then John the Baptist gets executed. That's this guy. He threatened to kill Jesus at one point, and Jesus said, go tell that fox that I'm going to do whatever my father wants me to do, and that's a lot of good stuff. Now, we don't think that's very offensive, but when Jesus said this, he was using fox in the feminine, so maybe there's something with that. Jesus was briefly on trial in front of Herod Antipas before he was sent on to Pilate. So that's that guy. Herod Philip, we don't hear a ton about. He was up in the north. It was a little weird that he married his niece. He built some cool stuff near Caesarea that you can still check out if you're in the Middle East. And some people liked this guy. So he seemed to be maybe a little more moderate. And then Aristobulus, who's his fourth son on there, that actually never got any power because he was executed in 7 BC at the hand of his dad. But his kids, Herod Agrippa I, he's the guy who messed with the early church. He had James arrested and executed, and then he was going to do the same to Peter, but he escaped. And then we have Herod Agrippa II, the last of the Herods. He's the one that Paul talked to and said to Paul, you almost convinced me to become a Christian. That's Herod Agrippa II. And it all comes to an end in 70 AD when the Romans just got tired of all these Jewish uprisings. They came in with their army, destroyed Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, and the Jews didn't have their own independent state for a long, long time. So in closing, Herod was important for Matthew to include in the story of Jesus because it put Jesus into the story of God's chosen people. It could be said that the whole story of the Old Testament is one where Yahweh, the real king, is protecting and bringing his people through the great injustices and atrocities under the rule and oppression of imposter kings, right? So Pharaoh is the anti-hero in Israel's story, but we actually learn, while, you know, he had a huge empire, he built massive things, he did terrible things to protect his sovereignty, his authority is actually really small, right? Through Moses, God shows his real power by sending in 10 plagues, by even hardening and softening Pharaoh's own heart. Yahweh is the true king. Pharaoh is shown to be an imposter. So Matthew compares and shows Herod as being the anti-hero imposter king that is showing his power by conquering Jerusalem with a Roman army, building large buildings and cities. But when his sovereignty is threatened, he kills his own families and babies. And he's outdueled by God through the story of Jesus. And eventually, his family's authority is taken away. Today, not much has changed. Governments tend to get a little drunk on their own power, and there's a God complex that comes with unchecked power. In the 20th century alone, governments have killed 262 million of their own citizens. There's an ancient lesson here. There is no hope in human authority. But in our own lives and in the lives of this world, in the lives of, in history, throughout all history, in all the insecurity, all the violence, all the chaos of the world, our God's authority is patient, benevolent, gracious, redemptive, as Matthew shows in the person of Jesus. No matter where you find yourself today, I'd encourage you to lean into him, because he's got us. Thank you.